Rocksteady, roots and culture, dub and dancehall, from the foundational Jamaican recordings to the latest international releases. That's Reggae Central, 2 to 5 p.m. every Sunday, right here on KPFK.
You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. The time now is 1 p.m.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Negwa Ibrahim. From the very start of the U.S.-Israeli invasion of Iran, academic institutions have been deliberately and systematically destroyed. Iran's Minister of Science, Research, and Technology says more than 30 universities have been bombed, and this was no accident. Israeli leaders and U.S. public figures have made clear these were intended targets, not collateral damage. Iran's Minister of Science put it simply, quote, attacking universities and research centers means returning to the Stone Age, end quote, a direct reference to U.S. President Donald Trump's threat to bomb Iran, in his words, back to the Stone Ages. Missile strikes have also targeted individual faculty members. Iran's Islamic Republic News Agency reported that Dr. Saeed Shimghadri, an associate professor at the Electoral Engineering Department at IUT, was killed in an airstrike along with his family on March 22nd. What is unfolding in Iran echoes what we witnessed in Gaza, the systematic erasure of not just campuses and classrooms, but of entire academic ecosystems. Students, scholars, research, the very conditions that make knowledge possible, all being destroyed. And as journalist Kourosh Ziabadi writes in his recent article, Iran's academia will bear significant costs if the ceasefire holds and the war comes to an end. In a country where education is one of the main pathways to success, especially for women who make up nearly 60% of university graduates, the long-term repercussions are expected to be grim. So with us today to talk about how the U.S. and Israel, throughout their war on Iran, have deliberately and systematically targeted Iranian academic institutions in violation of international humanitarian law, is our guest, Kourosh Ziabadi, an award-winning journalist and media studies researcher and contributor to Foreign Policy and New Line magazine. Welcome to Middle East in Focus, Kourosh Ziabadi.
Thanks very much for having me. It's a pleasure to join you today.
So let's start first with if you could tell us how many academic institutions in Iran have the U.S. and Israel targeted. I know I sort of mentioned what the estimates might be, but if you could sort of elaborate on that. And how do we know that the strikes are systematic and deliberate?
Based on the reports that have been published so far, it's somewhat difficult to gauge the exact number of the institutions, academic institutions and universities that have been targeted. But some statements by Iranian officials, including the Minister of Education, point to something between 20 to 30 institutions that have been either substantially damaged or at least partly damaged and during the airstrikes. And some of these institutions we know are among the most prestigious and prominent Iranian universities, including the Sharif University of Technology in Tehran or the Isfahan University of Technology in central Iran, or a couple of other institutions, again, in the Iranian capital, including the Shahid Beheshti University, formerly known as the National University of Iran. So to say whether or not these attacks have been systematic or they have been just, again, miscalculations or erroneous conduction of the military operation, it's really difficult. But what we know is that some of the attacks have been somewhat acknowledged, especially by the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, by arguing that, for example, this specific institution or center or lab within the university has been carrying out research that might have somehow contributed to some form of military development or research. which is still, in my perspective, fallacious argument, because any form of industrial research can in some way be redirected or instrumentalized to contribute to military ends. So in that sense, then all STEM departments, all science, technology, mathematics, education, academic institutions are pretty much, according to this logic, legitimate targets. And it shouldn't be the case. Otherwise, we are leaving no stone unturned in turning universities into legitimate grounds for military operations. Also, I would add that the fact that these are some of the really prominent universities, not just nationally, but regionally and internationally recognized institutions, and the fact that there has been little expression of regret or apologies by either the U.S. or Israeli governments when these attacks happened, is kind of an indication that there might be an intent behind either undermining educational pursuits in Iran, or at least that there is little care in conducting and carrying out these operations.
And can you talk about, based on this, that really what we're talking about is the deliberate targeting of essentially civilian infrastructure, of knowledge and thinking in Iran? Can you talk about how this actually is in violation of international humanitarian law, why it is that the entire world really should be outraged by this, because it affects both Iran but actually also the entire world?
That's correct. Speaking not as an expert in international law, because I'm not, but based on my understanding of what the law says here, I can make the case that this is apparently a clear violation of international law and international humanitarian law, especially given what has been embedded in the text of the Hague Conventions and the Geneva Conventions, both of which clearly indicate that if there is no military threat posed to an adversary or belligerent engaged in military activity or warfare, and then there is no justification for targeting those institutions, in which case Iranian universities have not been posing any threat to any party to this conflict. And, of course, to set a precedent in this point of time where we can see universities can easily be targeted and the perpetrators are pretty much facing no accountability or no repercussions, this is, I believe, a bad tradition that is being defined today in the conduction of military operations, because in the future, any country, any state or non-state actor that might be involved in military activities might make the case that in the enemy territory, there are universities and institutions that are conducting research. And my assumption, my fear, is that that research might contribute to some not benign goals, and so there are legitimate targets. And at the same time, there are, very renowned principles in international humanitarian law, including proportionality and distinction. Here, there's no distinction that has been drawn between civilian targets and military targets by the U.S. and Israel. Also, no proportion in the way these attacks have been carried out, which means that some, civilian institutions within civilian neighborhoods have been attacked. At the same time, to imagine an equivalent of, for example, Sharif University of Technology has always been likened to Iran's MIT, the fact that this is a major globally recognized institution in which some of the best, most brilliant academics, scholars have done research. So many American scholars, university professors, and also Nobel Prize laureates have visited the premises of Sharif University of Technology to deliver talks and give lectures. So there has been a long-standing tradition of academic exchange between the two sides. There is grounds and justification for denunciation, and there should be a clear outrage just because one attack on an institution of higher education is a declaration of a broader attack on such institutions everywhere.
And I actually now want to get into some of the specific universities that have been targeted and share with the listeners really the rich history of research, academia within Iran. So can you talk about some of the specific universities that have been targeted, such as Sharif University, and what, again, the destruction of these institutions means for research, academia, collaboration, and the wider world? Because, again, what's coming out of many of these institutions are things that are beneficial in terms of research and academic knowledge that is necessary to move us forward as a globe. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Of course. What you mentioned is exactly the crux of the challenge here, the fact that academic institutions in Iran have traditionally produced some of the best, most talented, gifted scholars that have gone on to develop enterprises globally. They have actually been credited with actually introducing some of the most successful startups in Silicon Valley and elsewhere. And they have originated, these scholars, these founders, these entrepreneurs have originated from Iranian institutions. I mean, at one point in the early 1980s, Iran was the first origin country of international students in the United States, even these days under wide constellation of travel restrictions and sanctions. Iranian students are one of the largest populations of international students in the U.S. And Iranian universities have been producing these minds, I mean, under years of sanctions, under years of economic punishment and inflicted isolation that the academic community in Iran has been subjected to. These universities have done great work. And you mentioned the Sharif University of Technology, of course, founded in 1966. This is a university, I mean, we probably know its most, or one of the most distinguished alumni it has ever produced, which is the late Maryam Mirzakhani, the first female recipient of a Fields Medal, which is the highest honor in mathematics, or, I mean, even in sports. I mean, once the former all-time international goal scorer in soccer, Ali Dai, former player of Iran's national soccer team, was a graduate of Sharif University of Technology. Other institutions that are unfortunately have been targeted during the recent airstrikes include Iran University of Science and Technology, which is also located in Tehran, and it's the first academic institution in the Middle East to ever establish a department of railroad engineering. These are institutions, or, I mean, for example, Isfahan University of Technology, located in the province of Isfahan, has been nurturing and cultivating some of the best, for example, agricultural research departments within Iranian universities. And all of these institutions have been thriving and fighting against the odds. First, domestic authoritarianism, repression, which have always existed as a pattern, limiting research and limiting excellence, stifling speech on campuses. At the same time, international sanctions and restrictions on research and access to events, opportunities. It's never been easy for Iranian scholars or university professors or other researchers to be able to travel freely. This is not a privilege that they enjoy like what their peers in the region or beyond enjoy. So they have been doing these contributions despite a constellation of challenges. And so to see that education in Iran is being considered a target in an illegal military campaign is really troubling, because the message it's sending is that the academic community in Iran moving forward should be living with fear, intimidation, and vulnerability, not because it's going to be restricted at home only. That's one layer of challenge. Moving forward, military powers are considering Iranian universities part of their calculations four campaigns of coercion and military action, unfortunately. And this precedent needs to be countered, otherwise it will evolve into a pattern of warfare in the future, and it's really risky and unfortunate.
Well, and to the point that you brought up just now about how, you know, Iranian academics, scholars, and universities have been fighting to survive and thrive, even despite efforts by the United States even prior to this to destroy academic institutions and the flourishing of knowledge and research in Iran through the history of economic sanctions. Can you talk a little bit about that and the impact that economic sanctions even prior to the war had, and how despite that, universities, research, and knowledge in Iran still thrived and fought for democracy?
Of course, and that's a very important question, often overlooked in our discourse around academic development in Iran, because you have to consider that any given Iranian university professor that we run into here in the U.S. has gone through a long history of hardships and difficulties, first to be able to survive cloistered and restricted environment at home, and also to be able to overcome the side effects and also the intended and unintended consequences of the sanctions on Iran's academic community. I mean, just consider the fact that for many Iranian students trying to apply to academic institutions overseas in any given country, some of them, they have to pay, for example, application fees as small as $50 or $75. But even to just complete the task under years of sanctions in an economy that has been financially segregated from the rest of the world, there's no straightforward and a smooth pathway to complete that process. You have to rely on institutions overseas that charge staggering commission fees just to pay your $75 admission fee or application fee. So you end up paying sometimes $150 to a broker or third party somewhere else in Iran's neighboring countries just to be able to apply to university. And then, so that's one of the repercussions of the sanctions, which we conveniently overlook, or the fact that for even students or scholars or researchers to travel either to study or do fellowships or just to attend an event or conference in a different country, especially in Western Europe and in North America, they go through stringent layers of immigration scrutiny, sometimes taking several months just to receive a single entry visa to be able to travel. This is, again, one of the very simple, but I mean, we are talking about it simple, but it is a notably challenging outcome of the sanctions. And then access to directories, resources, and sometimes international libraries, I mean, sometimes the subscription process ends up being a challenge. You cannot easily, as an Iranian academic institution, purchase a subscription to some of these online libraries that are just taken for granted in any given institution for students and scholars to download papers or obtain journals. These are just day-to-day hardships that sanctions have imposed on an academic community that is otherwise gifted, creative, and notably resilient. Otherwise, it wouldn't have survived all of these hardships over the years.
Coming to you from the studios of listener-supported KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Middle East in Focus. I'm Negwa Ibrahim, very happy to be joined by Kourash Ziabadri, an award-winning journalist and media studies researcher and contributor to Foreign Policy and New Lines magazine, talking with us today about how the U.S. and Israel, throughout their war on Iran, have deliberately and systematically targeted Iranian academic institutions in violation of international humanitarian law. So I want to now, Kourash, get into one of the things that you talk about in your most recent piece, and that is about Representative Ansari, who maybe a lot of people don't know about. Who is Representative Ansari, and what was her what has her response been to the U.S.-Israeli invasion of Iran, both in terms of the strikes on academic institutions and her broader opposition to the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran?
Sure. So Representative Yasmin Ansari is actually a member of the House of Representatives from the 3rd Congressional District in the state of Arizona. And she is the first Iranian-American Democrat in the Congress. She's obviously a young politician who formerly worked as a member of the Climate Change Advisory Council to the UN Secretary General. She has worked throughout years as a politician who has made progress through different layers and steps of political progress, from the deputy mayor of Phoenix in Arizona to member of the House of Representatives. So she's been also very outspoken in responding to the military conflagration and the violation of Iran's sovereignty and the commission of war crimes. Especially, she has introduced an articles of impeachment against set of articles of impeachment against Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, citing his rhetoric and also his role in the bombing of an Iranian elementary school on the first day of the U.S.-Israeli airstrikes and war on Iran, which resulted in the killing of more than 150 girls, school girls, basically. And she has been, from a very principled position, just raising the fact that this war doesn't have any congressional authorization, so it's illegal, basically. Also, it doesn't have any plan or strategy, which means that it's very rudderless and confused as a military effort. And in response to my questions about the attack on Iranian universities, she has lamented and deplored the fact that there has been little denunciation of these airstrikes on Iranian universities by other institutions. And she hopes that, that's what I heard from her in our brief interview. She hopes that other members of Congress also speak out and react to these unfortunate and unprecedented attacks on higher education, because in principle, any attack on any university is a declaration of assault on higher education everywhere. So the fact that there is a bit of complacency and reluctance on behalf of institutions of higher education, both in the U.S. and elsewhere in Europe, to criticize or at least call out these airstrikes has been surprising to me and to others, and also to politicians like Congresswoman Ansari, who has reacted to this. And also, I would add that she has been herself someone who has gone through a history of, firsthand encounters with authoritarianism, both in Iran and now. Of course, she is being unfortunately attacked a lot here because of her opposition to the war. But her family fled Iran because they were facing repression at home. So, to frame the entirety of the situation in a realistic manner, I would say any politician who sees the facts on the ground and who is able to recognize their mandate to uphold the Constitution would be able to easily judge and conclude that everything in this conflict, everything in this war, which has now been temporarily halted due to the two-week ceasefire, has been unlawful and questionable and needs some form of serious response. So that's basically her position.
So I want to get into the point that you were just making about her position, and also what you have reflected on as well in your work, about just how shocking it is and unacceptable it has been that U.S. universities have remained silent on the fact that their Iranian counterparts are being deliberately destroyed and systematically targeted, especially given the long history of engagement between U.S. and Iranian universities, even under difficult diplomatic circumstances over the years. Why do you think it is that U.S. universities have largely remained silent as Iranian universities are being deliberately targeted by the U.S. And Israeli government?
Right. So that's, again, a very good question, an important question to reflect on. And I would say, yes, despite more than 47 years of diplomatic estrangement and lack of formal ties between the governments of Iran and the United States, there have been many instances of successful academic partnership and collaboration between Iranian universities and U.S. universities, and they are the lifelines of some of the basic lifelines of people-to-people exchanges. They have made it possible for the two nations to talk to each other, to learn from each other, and for the manufactured hostility between the two governments not to degenerate and evolve into broader hostilities between two nations, which have had a long history of cordial and friendly ties, both in terms of cultural exchanges and other forms of connection, engagement. But to see that the institutions right now in the U.S. and elsewhere are not speaking out and are not denouncing these attacks, even though it's unfortunate, I can try to understand. I can at least try to relate to it, which is probably the climate of intimidation and harassment that has been introduced by the Trump administration against universities. I mean, most prestigious universities, elite universities in the U.S., have been blackmailed by this administration since it came to power under different pretexts. Under different excuses, multi-million-dollar lawsuits have been filed against universities, either to silence them or just to coerce them into changing their curriculum, or to limit the student activism, or to, in many cases, get rid of some student populations or deport students on again made-up charges. So to see that universities are not reacting, I guess. It's unfortunate, but it's not inconceivable in the current climate. I mean, the fact that, I mean, during the Vietnam War, most university campuses in the U.S. Have been the scene of uprisings against the U.S. government for engaging in a conflict that resulted in unspeakable humanitarian tragedies, killing of thousands of civilians. And to see that it's not happening today in response to a similar tragedy in which Iranian institutions, Iranian civilians, Iranian hospitals, research centers are being bombed and destroyed. Of course, I'm confident there is a level of sympathy and understanding and maybe frustration within academic institutions, but to see them not being able to muster the resources and courage to stand up, of course, I guess what the Trump administration has shown over the past year or so might be a good explanation that universities and their communities have been coerced into silence and intimidation, unfortunately.
Well, and I think, you know, the what you're raising is so important when we also understand this idea of a true democracy, and really true democracy can only flourish, can only exist through true academic freedom and through the thriving of universities and academic institutions, which what you're describing and what others have talked about is being deliberately attacked and targeted by the U.S. government, both here in the United States as well as around the world, in Gaza, in Iran, and in other places, and so that, you know, like you said, an attack on one university is an attack on all universities, which is actually an attack on any sort of true, real democracy. And we saw this play out in Gaza as well, which the United States was absolutely complicit and part of. And I want to get to that about how the U.S.-Israeli targeting of universities universities in Iran compares to what happened in Gaza? And then what does this systematic dismantling and destruction of academic institutions means for long-term cultural and intellectual future of a nation like Iran, but also for the world? Because this is really something that impacts all of us.
Exactly. And I was reading a story on the concept of a scholasticide in Gaza and how universities and institutions of higher education and even schools, I mean, pretty much every academic and educational institution was either impacted or implicated during the 2 years of the war in Gaza. And I believe that what happened was that the Israeli government, regardless of any of its commitments under international law as an occupying power and as a party to a conflict in which there is a huge imbalance of power, for example, in one instance, it apparently either destroyed or damaged all 12 universities in Gaza. According to the United Nations and the Office of Humanitarian Coordination within the UN, more than 90% of schools were either partially or completely destroyed. So when this happens and when there are justifications associated with that, then I guess we are facing a grim landscape in which powers intoxicated with military prowess and military build-ups do not see any limit as to how they can conduct themselves and which targets they choose to eliminate. And I fear that if this pattern continues without any scrutiny or without any response by the legitimate authorities, including the UN Security Council, and other bodies in charge of enforcing international law, this is going to become a long-term concern because other authoritarian governments might replicate and might take their instructions from what's happening today. I mean, we have to consider that at some point this conflict will come to an end, and either Iran will make some concessions or the U.S. will just feel, and the Israeli government will feel that enough is enough and they cannot carry out this wanton violence forever. But 20 years from now, Iranian institutions will be reflecting on what happened during these days. And every institution in which there is a trace and footstep of a U.S.-Israeli missile or bomb will be remembering that with bitterness. And this is going to contribute to a long-term climate of impossibility, the closure of the avenues to dialogue, to reconciliation. We cannot bomb universities and research institutions in other countries and expect their scholars, their future leaders, their future researchers to reflect on what happened favorably, to praise what happened, to be either indifferent or even happy. Let's remember that also in Iran, given its history of being subjected to foreign aggression and including the 8-year war with Iraq, in which the former Iraqi dictator was supported by many major global powers, these are the scars of the history on the Iranian psyche that have not even been completely erased, or the 1953 coup in which the U.S. and Britain joined to topple a democratic government in Tehran. So to remember that 20 years from now or 30 years from now, when people will reflect on this and remember that a wanted ICC war criminal and his ally in the U.S. joined to erase academic institutions in Iran at the same time as carrying out an all-out war on the country without any provocation or justification, this is not going to be remembered favorably and fondly. Unfortunately, the leaders of this war should recognize that they are not just taking some action in response to a momentary impulse. They are also changing the course of history and how it will be written and how it will be recorded not just by Iranian academics, by pretty much everyone in the region who values academic activity and research and higher education.
We have been talking with Kurash Ziabadi, an award-winning journalist and media studies researcher and contributor to Foreign Policy and New Lines magazine, about how the U.S. and Israel, throughout their war on Iran, have deliberately and systematically targeted Iranian academic institutions in violation of international humanitarian law. Thank you, Kurash Ziabadi, for joining us today on Middle East in Focus.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
So as legal scholar Marjorie Cohen writes, while the world's attention is focused on the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran and Donald Trump's genocidal proclamations, Israel is simultaneously perpetrating a genocide in Lebanon. And the world community's continued failure to stop Israel's genocide in Gaza has actually emboldened it to replicate the same genocidal strategy in Lebanon. And here to talk about exactly that is Marjorie Cohen, professor of emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, dean of the People's Academy of International Law, and past president of the National Lawyers Guild. Her books include Drones and Targeted Killings, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. Welcome, Marjorie Cohen, back to Middle East in Focus. We really appreciate your expertise and for joining us once again to share that knowledge with all of us today.
Well, thank you for having me back, Nagwa.
So I want to actually dive in a little bit on some of the things we were talking about in the previous segment and maybe get into a little bit more of some of the legalese. Our last guest just talked about how the U.S. and Israel are systematically targeting and destroying academic institutions in Iran. Can you discuss, based on your legal expertise, why this violates international humanitarian law and how the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran violates the United Nations Charter and has given rise to Iran's legitimate exercise of self-defense? And then from there, we'll get into Lebanon.
Yes. Well, under the Fourth Geneva Convention on the Protection of Civilians, you cannot target civilians or civilian objects, and certainly universities constitute civilian objects. So this constitutes a war crime. What is happening in Iran, the targeting of the universities, the U.S.-Israeli strikes. And yes, the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran squarely violates the UN Charter, which requires that all countries settle their disputes peacefully and not use armed force except in self-defense. Self-defense is only allowed after an armed attack against a UN country by another country, or when it's authorized by the Security Council. Now, before February 28th, Iran had not mounted an armed attack against any country, nor did it even pose an imminent threat to the US, Israel, or any other UN member country, and the Security Council certainly had not authorized the use of military force against Iran. So what the US and Israel are doing in Iran is committing aggression. Aggression was considered at Nuremberg to be the supreme international crime because it includes all the other crimes, war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity in it. And an act of aggression violates the UN Charter because it's the use of armed force by a country against the sovereignty, territorial integrity, or political independence of that country. And aggression includes the invasion or attack by the armed forces of a country on the territory of another country. Well, even if you buy the U.S.-Israeli justification for attacking Iran to purportedly prevent it from acquiring nuclear weapons, preemptive strikes are not allowed under the UN Charter. That constitutes aggression. Now, Article 51 of the Charter says nothing in the Charter shall impair the inherent right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs against a member of the UN. And after the U.S. and Israel mounted these armed attacks of aggression, Iran at that point was allowed to act in self-defense.
Okay, so now I want to get into Lebanon, but it relates to some of the things you just brought up, which is the fact, and again, please correct me if I'm misstating anything, but it seems as of now, the UN Security Council has done nothing to stop this unlawful U.S.-Israeli invasion of Iran. Is that right?
That is correct. The U.S. vetoes any Security Council resolution that would stop Israel's carnage, either in Gaza and in this instance in Iran and then in Lebanon as well.
So in many ways, I mean, the U.S. and Israel are acting with impunity in Iran, which sort of paves the way for what we're also seeing in Lebanon by Israel, which I believe the U.S. is also complicit in, and we'll talk about that. So now I want to get to what Israel is doing in Lebanon. As you talk about in your article, Trump threatened genocide in Iran on April 7th, stating, quote, "a whole civilization will die tonight," end quote. And yet, despite an agreed two-week ceasefire, Israel actually immediately intensified attacks on Lebanon, even though Lebanon was also covered by the ceasefire. Can you now walk us through what Israel is doing in Lebanon and why it actually amounts to genocide?
Well, yes, Nagwa, the Israeli actions in Lebanon fall squarely within the definition of genocide in the Genocide Convention. The Genocide Convention defines genocide as acts committed with the intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group. And those acts can include either killing members of the group, or inflicting serious bodily or mental harm on members of the group, or deliberately inflicting conditions of life calculated to bring about the group's physical destruction in whole or in part. And Israel is committing all three of those genocidal acts. Since March 2nd, Israel has killed at least 2,300 people in Lebanon and wounded over 7,185. And there are untold numbers of bodies buried under the rubble. On April the 8th, the date of the ceasefire agreement, the Israeli military actually stepped up its aggression in Lebanon, launching more than 100 airstrikes within 10 minutes and across multiple areas simultaneously, including in densely populated areas in Beirut, with no warning, killing at least 303 people and injuring more than 1,150 people. Israel is also conducting mass demolitions in several Lebanese villages along the Israel-Lebanon border. The Israeli military is rigging homes with explosives and razing them to the ground with remote detonations. Israel has destroyed or damaged more than 40,000 homes in Lebanon. And the possibility that Hezbollah may use some civilian structures in Lebanon's border villages for military purposes does not justify the wide-scale destruction of entire villages along the border. That's according to Human Rights Watch. And when there is a doubt about whether or not it is a military or civilian target, the presumption is that it's a civilian target. Now, Israel has said that it will occupy large swaths of southern Lebanon to establish a so-called security zone in the entire area up to the Litani River, and that displaced people will not be allowed to return to their homes until there's a guarantee of safety for northern Israeli cities. Now, if the displacement, the forcible displacement of 2 million people in Gaza is any indication, that could mean long-term and even permanent displacement. In addition, Israel is disabling Lebanon's healthcare infrastructure. They've launched more than 90 attacks targeting hospitals, medical staff, ambulances, and first aid centers since March the 2nd. And Israel's destruction of hospitals and medical equipment is deterring people from obtaining medical care. So is the Israeli military claims that Hezbollah is using medical facilities for terrorist activity, but it's provided no evidence to support that claim. Israel is destroying water and sanitation infrastructure in Lebanon. In 4 days, during the first week of the war, Israel damaged at least 7 critical water sources, including reservoirs, pipe networks, and pumping stations that supplied water to almost 7,000 people in the Bekaa area alone. Israel has destroyed electricity networks, cutting off vital supplies and services for entire villages and at least 7 bridges over the Litani River, which links southern Lebanon to the rest of the country, have been struck by the Israeli military. Finally, Israel has forced 22% of the population of Lebanon, more than 1.2 million people, including 350,000 children, from their homes. And according to the Lemkin Institute for Genocide Prevention and Human Security, the scale, geographic scope, and coordinated intensity of these actions indicate an intent not merely to strike military objectives, but to inflict broad suffering and create conditions of life that render civilian existence unsustainable. Israel is inflicting absolute terror on the Lebanese people.
So in addition to the genocidal acts, which you've just very clearly laid out that Israel is committing in Lebanon, there actually have been statements made by Israeli officials that further show their clear intent to commit genocide in Lebanon. Can you take us through some of those statements?
Yes. And remember, once again, Nagwa, that in order to constitute genocide, you need a genocidal attack, which I've just mentioned, the killing, the conditions unsustainable for human life and the injuring of people. But then you also need to have an intent to commit genocide. And we see that intent very clearly from statements that Israeli officials have made. Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz called for the destruction of, quote, all houses, unquote, in Lebanon's border villages, quote, in accordance with the model used in Rafah and Beit Hanun in Gaza, unquote. Well, the Israeli military destroyed 90% of the homes in Rafah in southern Gaza. And in Beit Hanun, tens of thousands of people were forced to flee, and Israel burned entire neighborhoods to the ground in a scorched earth policy. Israel Katz, the defense minister in Israel, said that Israel would continue to destroy homes in Lebanese towns near Israel's northern border. Also, former Israeli defense minister Yoav Gallant said, we need to strike and eliminate everything that's in Dayei, Baalbek, Tyre, Sidon, and Nabatea, everywhere, unquote. Now, Gallant is facing war crimes and crimes against humanity prosecution, along with Netanyahu, in front of the International Criminal Court. So he is an accused war criminal. Also, Yair Lapid, who is an Israeli opposition leader, admitted that it, quote, may be unpleasant to scrape away 2 or 3 Lebanese villages, unquote, but he said it would be necessary. So Israel has stated that it does not plan to leave Lebanon even when the current war ends. Israel appears to be moving toward expanding its border into Lebanon, and Israel is in the process of redrawing the map of the Middle East, particularly in Lebanon, to further its goal of creating, quote, greater Israel, unquote.
Coming to you from the studios of listener-supported KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Middle East in Focus. I'm Negwa Ibrahim, very happy to be joined by Marjorie Cohen, a professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, dean of the People's Academy of International Law, and past president of the National Lawyers Guild, talking with us about Israel's genocide in Lebanon and how Israel's genocide in Gaza has emboldened it to replicate its genocidal strategy there. You sort of, I think, already started to lay out what some of the differences are between crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide. But if you can just sort of take us more specifically into those differences between legally, the difference between war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. And in addition to the genocidal acts Israel's committing in Lebanon, can you speak to the specific war crimes and crimes against humanity Israel is committing there, and what the role the United States is playing in all of those crimes?
Yes, the Fourth Geneva Convention considers grave breaches to be war crimes, and those grave breaches include the targeting of civilians, the wanton destruction of infrastructure, and the unlawful transfer of a population. All three of those things are being done by Israel in Lebanon. So those are war crimes. Crimes against humanity include, the ones that Israel is committing, include forcible transfer, extermination, murder, and other inhumane acts of a similar character, intentionally causing great suffering or serious injury to body or to mental or physical health. So Israel is committing all of those crimes as part of a widespread or systematic attack directed against the civilian population with knowledge of the attack, as defined by the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court. That's the definition of crimes against humanity. Now, the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court also allows for prosecution of leaders who are aiding and abetting the crimes of genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity. And Donald Trump and Pete Hegseth and the other U.S. leaders fall squarely into that category, as well as the U.S. Congress that appropriates $3.8 billion every year for military aid to Israel, in addition to billions more that have been appropriated to support Israel's genocide in Gaza for the last 2.5 years, and now the war, the wars in Iran and Lebanon. And plus, the U.S. government consistently, and this has been going on for years, provides Israel with political and diplomatic cover for its atrocious crimes by vetoing any resolutions in the Security Council that aim to stop the carnage, and providing diplomatic and political support uncritically. And Netanyahu, in many ways, is, I don't want to say he's running the show, because every once in a while Donald Trump will say, "Oh, we've told Israel they can't continue bombing Lebanon," as they continue bombing Lebanon. But yes, this aiding and abetting, which Donald Trump, Pete Hegseth, and the rest of their team are engaging in, can also be prosecuted under the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court.
And so, just to be clear, so the U.S. and Israel are committing war crimes and crimes against humanity in Iran, but it would not yet amount to genocide. And then as far as Lebanon, they are committing war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide in Lebanon. Is that correct? Argue that there could be acts of genocide in Iran? Could you just sort of explain that a little bit?
I think there could be, the argument could be made, especially not just the killing and the serious bodily injury, but also the destruction of the infrastructure in Iran approaches a genocidal act. But I do think that that the case is crystal clear for genocide in Gaza and in Lebanon on the part of the U.S. and Israel.
So now I want to get into an important point that you make in your piece and just in general in your work. And you state that the continued failure of the world community to stop Israel's genocide in Gaza has emboldened it to replicate its genocidal strategy in Lebanon. Can you explain for us why you believe that to be the case? And can you actually speak to Israel's long track record of unlawful attacks in Lebanon and the impunity that has allowed that pattern of violence and atrocities to continue unchecked until today?
Yes, this impunity, as I said, is enabled by largely by the United States, its allies as well, but the United States, one of the permanent members of the Security Council that continues to veto any resolution in the Security Council that would stop this genocide. Also, the Congress, which has failed to invoke the War Powers Resolution, which we can talk about in a minute, to stop Trump's involvement. But, you know, Nagua, I want to mention before talking about the history of Israeli crimes in Lebanon, which I will get to, is that what Israel has done with the help of the United States for the last 2.5 years in Gaza is the first live streamed genocide in our history. You can't pick up your phones, social media, your TV sets, the newspapers, without seeing, even on like PBS NewsHour, which, you know, it's not breaking news, it's not perfect, but you know, every single day you see pictures of people who are being displaced, who are you know, suffering from what Israel is doing. And that live stream genocide has really turned people against what Israel is doing, and in turn what Trump is doing. And now the majority of people in this country, this is unheard of, that at the beginning of a war, they are opposed to what is happening. They're also opposed to the high gas prices as well. But this impunity that has that has enabled Israel to commit this genocide and war crimes and crimes against humanity and aggression for all these years has been enabled largely by the United States. Now, in terms of Lebanon, in 1948, the same year that Israel was established following the genocide of the Palestinians in the Nakba, Israeli forces invaded southern Lebanon and committed their first massacre against Lebanese civilians. And ever since, Israeli forces have conducted repeated cross-border attacks into Lebanon. In 1982, Israel launched a full-scale invasion of Lebanon, bombarding and besieging Beirut, and oversaw genocidal massacres in the Palestinian refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila, which were perpetrated by the Israel-backed far-right Christian militia called the Falange. Hezbollah emerged after 1982 as a resistance to Israeli attacks and as a form of Shia self-defense within Lebanon's complex ethnic and religious demography and brutal civil war. Now, after the October 7th, 2023 attacks in Israel escalated into full-scale genocide, in September of 2024, over 3,000 Lebanese civilians were killed by Israel, 14,000 were injured, and more than 1.2 people were displaced. In September of 2024, Israel detonated handheld electronic devices in civilian areas of Lebanon, which remotely triggered multiple explosions of electronic pagers and walkie-talkies that killed at least 37 people, including a 9-year-old girl and 11-year-old boy, and maimed or injured 3,250 people, 200 critically. And the Israeli military has extensively destroyed and damaged civilian structures and agricultural land in southern Lebanon between the 1st of October 2024 and January 26th of 2025, continuing well beyond the November 2024 ceasefire.
Thank you, Marjorie Cohen. We have been talking today about Israel's genocide in Lebanon and how Israel's genocide in Gaza has emboldened it to replicate its genocidal strategy there with our guest, Marjorie Cohen, professor of emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, dean of the People's Academy of International Law, and past president of the National Lawyers Guild. Again, thank you so much, Marjorie Cohen, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Nagua.
I also want to thank our fantastic engineer, Carlos, all of you, the listeners. Our theme song is the overture from Summer Night's Dream by Marcel Khalife. For Middle East in Focus, I'm Negwa Ibrahim, wishing you all light, love, peace, and justice.
Airs here on KPFK every Sunday evening from 10 p.m. until midnight. Coming up tonight...
While attempting to discover the roots of Hamlet's unhappiness, two courtiers go on a journey to plumb the depths of the universe's mysteries.
What's the first thing you remember?
The first thing that comes into my head, you mean?
No, the first thing you remember.